And I decided to run again. And when I ran again, I got the appropriate promises from everybody I needed to the next time. To leave my, stay out of my race, let me run the race. And everything was going really well until they kind of realized that I was doing too well. And then they called in the favors and I got a call one night saying, we just received word that we're not allowed to vote for you. And so we're sorry. And like, I had the support of everybody I needed to.
They
understand that they're going to be there. They don't know where they're going, right? But they understand they're going to get there. And so they understand that when I'm dead, like, I'm not taking anything with me. My real trick was trying to get them to understand that their family, assuming they had multiple children, were going to fight horribly. Families do not really stay together after the elders are gone. And it's super rare.
Dr. Bradford, first of all, you know, I really appreciate you spending the time with me chatting about a couple of things. I'm very curious to know your law practice. You know, last time you gave me like a quick intro into what all things you have been doing, and that made me very curious. At the same time, if you ask me, I think of law as something very stressful. And the way you presented your law practice last time, I think you are very passionate about it. So that gives me hope, because I almost get nervous when I think about things like that. So that is one thing I would want to chat about. And apart from that, you know, yeah, you talked about your personal life as well, how, you know, certain events kind of shaped you to do what you're doing right now. So if we can, you know, bring both the worlds on the pod, I would say that would be pretty amazing.
Certainly. So I guess really to begin, I kind of give you a little bit of my background and how I got to where I am today. And part of that went through the law. I'm no longer a licensed attorney, but I'll tell you that. So I always wanted to be a politician growing up. I was just one of those ambitious kids. I wanted to save the world. And the only way to do that is to go into politics, right? And so I knew, you know, here in the States that the way to be a politician is you have to be an attorney. And that's what I knew. Like, my little 10-year-old brain thought like this was the path. So I charted out my career path. I was going to go to college, and then I was going to go to law school, and then become an attorney, and then run for office. And so I did that. And to answer your question, is the law stressful? Is it? It is so. Law school is like the intellectual version of boot camp. So, you know, new recruits going into the military, they get just run ragged. They have to do early mornings, late nights, and they just never get a break. And that's exactly what law school was like, except we had to read the whole time. So I was, I think we mathed it out, the students, while we were complaining, and it was something like 300 pages of reading a night, every single night for, you know, several years at a time there. And in particular, where I was at in Ohio in the United States, it was a very particularly cloudy location. It was, I think it's the like third or fifth location in the States with the least amount of sunshine per year. So I can literally say I did not see the sun for 6 months as well while going through this. And, but it just, this extremely stressful situation. I remember like during orientation, my very first day, I didn't even know my teacher's names. I didn't know anybody. We got into one big auditorium together, all of the students for orientation, and they brought out the biggest, scariest professor that they had. And he did that thing where he says, you know, look to your left, look to your right. You know, one of the three of you isn't going to be here next year. And that's kind of how they presented it. It's how they framed it, is like, this is an experience that you have to grind your way through. And if you're not the kind of person who's capable of it, get out. And that actually happened. I had a student in my very first class. I'm not going to name her name, but we had a professor, and he just raked her over the coals. He just asked her these all these questions, just rapid fire that, and the case she had to read was this big. So like you would think, oh, you know, it's easy to memorize that, right? But he would ask her like background, like, did you look up what that word meant? And just, she dropped out immediately after that class ended.
Wow.
Really? And that's...
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You dropped out? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I had another class with her immediately thereafter. And I remember her sitting in the hallway just grumbling. And then she decided not to go into the class. She just went straight to the administrative office and unenrolled. And that was my experience, my first day of law school. So I got through that. And I had intended to move before I ever set foot into that law school building. I knew I was going to go to a different part of the country. And on January 1st, my last semester of my last year of law school, I met my now wife. And about a month or so after I met her, I had to make a decision whether I was going to stay and pursue love or I was going to go and pursue the career I'd always destined myself to have. And so I stayed for love. And it all worked out. I ended up getting a job at a court, starting out as a part-time law clerk, and ended up within about 7 months becoming the staff attorney, the bailiff, and the court administrator for the county court. And they had me on the judge track. They wanted me to be a politician. I'm like, this is what I wanted. And so I started going to the political fundraisers, getting to meet the people. And I realized that politicians behind closed doors are not the kind of people that they present themselves to the public. And it's starkly different. And I wanted nothing to do with that. So I decided, okay, well, I don't want to be on the judge track anymore. I might as well go into private practice. And so I found a job at a law practice. They'd been around for 28 years at the time, one of the most established in our state. And I started off just as an attorney. Like, I'd never talked to any real client before, and here I am, and I was told I had to make sales and close clients and then do the work, and this whole new experience for me. And maybe it's because I was good, maybe it was because I had a baby face, I'll never really know, but all these little old ladies who'd come into the office would sit down with me, and I would leave with $5,000, $10,000, $25,000 checks to do legal work for them almost every single time. So after about 6 months of doing this, I was promoted to partner at this 28-year-old law practice at the age of 27, making me, I do not know for a certainty, but I'm willing to say that I was the youngest named partner in the state of Ohio at an established firm. I then went and wrote the book on elder law, the Thompson West publication, and I went and then taught elder law to attorneys who were 30 and 40 years older than I was around the state, and which I thought was ironic because here I am 27 years old and I'm teaching people 57, 67 years old, a subject of law you'd think that they were closer to and they would have a little bit better grasp of. But, you know, that's how it works out. And it was about that point that I got a kind of a big head on my shoulders. I started thinking pretty highly of myself because, like, here I was at the court and I did all these amazing things, and here I'm at the law practice, I did these amazing things. I'm only 2 years out of law school. You know, where else am I going to go at this practice? Like, as an attorney, being a partner in an established firm that's kind of it, right? Like, where there's nowhere else to up, right? So what I decided to do is, my wife had just graduated law school, and we figured, why don't we start our own law practice and just go into business for ourselves, make something that we can be proud of. So we did that. I left the practice, and like most small businesses who have never really had any experience running a business or entrepreneurship in any capacity, our first year was particularly rough. And so much so that we owed $10,000 of taxes because I had been a partner. March of, I think it was 2014. Don't quote me on the year. At this point, it's been a while. And I had $500 in my bank account. So I owe $10,000, I have $500, and I have no idea what I'm going to do to be able to pay this, because we were doing everything. We had, you know, ad in the phone book, and we had coupons, and we were going to networking events. We were doing all the things that attorneys are taught to do.
Yeah.
Right. And so I had a friend who knew my situation, and he's like, you know, Brad, I'm going to give you my secret to getting clients. I'm like, please tell me anything. He's like, okay, have you ever heard of this thing called the Facebook? Like, Yeah, my generation has used it for a few years now. I think I'm familiar with that one. And so he's like, yeah, they got these things called groups. okay? And like, he was dead serious telling me this in this way. But if you just take an ad and you put it on these groups, you'll have more clients you know what to do with. I'm like, okay, like this was still back when organic marketing worked and I didn't know that. I like had never really tried any sort of social media advertising. Like, why not? I'll give it a shot.
Let's try it out.
I have nothing left to lose, right? It's either this or go to jail.
Yeah.
So I made this ad, my very first time really ever using Photoshop. I made this ad, ugly thing. I put it up into these groups on Facebook. And about 5 minutes after posting it, we got our phone started ringing. We answer it and it's a client. They schedule with us and we hang up the phone. And then 5 minutes later, our phone rings again. And we got another potential client. Okay. And 5 minutes later, it was like literally it just kept ringing. And at this point, I'm like, where else can I post that ad? And so about a year and a half, within the next year and a half, we had built one of the fastest growing firms in the state of Ohio. We had several attorneys working for us, multiple staff members. We had to expand our offices and like everything was just going great. My wife, whose name was on the door, it was not my name. Her name was on the door. She was being invited around the state to teach attorneys how to get clients and how to do digital marketing. And all of the ethics that go in with advertising online and social media. And like, it's just a fantastic situation. Like I like to say I did it again, right? It only took me a year and a half this time. 2.5 years, I guess, if we count that first year, which didn't go so well. But then it all kind of just ended one day when my wife nearly died in childbirth, while giving birth to my daughter. And, you know, just for like 24 hours, the alarm was blaring and there was a crash team outside her room and just terror. Like the doctors were concerned the entire time. And thankfully they got through. But my daughter comes out, they put her on my wife's chest and my wife looks up at me and goes, "I'm not going back to work." And she was the trial attorney for the firm. So if you don't have a trial attorney for your firm, you don't have a law practice. And, that it was okay. Like basically the firm exploded right then and there. It was all done. And I then took about 6 months to care for my wife and daughter to get them back up to health. And in that time I had to figure out what am I going to do? Because I never really wanted to be an attorney. That's never why I went to law school. It was not like my life purpose to be an attorney like some people. So what is it that I can do with my life? And so I decided that, you know, I had been doing business law at our law practice for about a year. And I really liked it. I liked working with businesses. I liked showing them how to, you know, do their contracts and negotiations. And I thought this was really cool. So I decided to become a business consultant and got a few clients here and there, like kind of small businesses and nothing that satisfied my ambition. So my wife said, you know what? We live in a small town. We're going to get small clients. Why don't we move to a larger city? And so I moved to Las Vegas and I'm here now. And, got to town and did my normal, you know, old thinking of advertising. I went to networking events and I started glad handing again. I just, that old thinking popped in again. And this time it worked because about 3 weeks after I'd moved into town, I met a guy at an event. We were at a Chili's, just a networking event. It's just a chain restaurant. And he's in a back corner. I never learned his name, but like, I got a chance to like talk to him over a couple people when he's in this booth and I'm standing on the side and he's like, "I like you, Brad. I want you to introduce you to some people. So, you know, I'll get in touch with you. Just wait for my call." I'm like, that's really strange, but okay. Well, it turned out he was one of the principals of an international business consulting firm and they had offices in 4 states. And the other principals, you know, between these three guys had something like 120 to 140 years of experience between them. And they just so happened to like young guys and they wanted to teach me. And I'm like, okay, why not? Right? Like, what do I have to lose here? So I sit down at their meeting with them and they're talking about their clients and what they got to do. And they divvy up the work. And they're like, "Brad, you know, if you want to come back next week, see how the clients progress, you know, see how the big boys do it. We'd be happy to have you." Like, yes, please. Right. Yeah, absolutely. I'll come back. So I show up again the next week and it was the strangest thing because none of the guys, not one of those three guys had done anything for their clients. Like one guy's like, "My wife needed me to do some gardening." And the other guy's like, "It was too hot in town. I went up to the mountain to cool off." And I'm like, wow, this is how business is done. Like, okay, you know, I'm a small town attorney. What do I know? Right. Like, Okay. But they divvy up the work again. They talk about the clients and they're like, Brad, if you want to come back next week, we'd be happy to have you again. I'm just like, okay. So I show up for week three. And this time, nothing happened again. Not one of those guys had done anything for the clients. And so I'm like, you know what? This is not strange. This is an opportunity. So when they started divvying up the clients again, I started raising my hand. I'm like, I'll do that. Like, sure, I'll figure that out. I don't know what that term means, but I will go look it up and see what I can do for you. Every assignment that they had, I took. 2 weeks later, they hired me to be the president of their company. And now here I am running an international business consulting firm, trying to figure out financing and international operations and just all of this stuff that I had no clue about. And like, I'd be studying and like read something. And the next day I would like, you know what I think? I would quote what I had just read in the book the night before. Right. And they're like, oh, that sounds great. And then they would go implement what I'd like, hopefully it was right. Right. But like, I figured it out. And so we did pretty well for ourselves, to the tune of about a year after I started working with these guys. They all decided that the firm was smooth sailing, that they could walk away and leave me to do all of the work that, you know, the four of us had been doing. And they were just going to skim off the top till the end of my days. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's a good deal for me. So I decided to leave and start my own business once again. And this time I did pretty well for myself. I've advised businesses in 20 plus different industries. I have advised entrepreneurs and business owners in 43 countries, and have personally referred over $2.5 billion of business funding needs to various investors, angels, lenders. And what I have learned from all that experience, I guess I don't want to leave it there. Like, there's more to the story. It's actually really funny. I had all that. Okay. So those stats I just told you, I had all that. And one day I sat down with a potential client and that I was looking to sign, and he was in the video game space. He was a streamer. I wanted to do some marketing consulting with him, just kind of get his brand going. And he's like, you know, Brad, everything you just told me is absolutely fantastic. I only have one question for you. Like, okay, yeah, what? How many followers do you have? I don't have any. Like, I don't care about my own social media. Like, this is what I do over here. He's like, yeah, that's what matters to me. And that's what matters to my space and my industry. And like, if you can't prove that you can do it, I don't believe that you can do it for me. Well, like, okay, fine. If that's how it's going to be played. So I started my own podcast. So, you know, right on for doing what you're doing. And I got guests onto my show. And every time I'd have a guest, I would just ask them, you know, who's the most important person that you know that I could have on my show? And they just kept introducing me to people. And before I knew it, I was interviewing NASCAR drivers and CEOs of companies making tens of millions of dollars. And one particular guest became my business partner. And that business partner introduced me to world champion athletes. And it all culminated in me getting to be the first person in 10 years to be able to spend the night at Don King's training camp this past January when he was putting on a heavyweight title fight. And so that's kind of the culmination of my journey, is I've just keep working. It's never been that I've had this grand plan. I think a lot of people think that they have to have a grand plan. I've never had a grand plan. Well, I have. It just has never gotten to what I wanted it to be. It just, and I keep seeming to fail. I keep losing what I have, but I keep getting more and more. And I think that's what really the entrepreneur journey is.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have one very interesting question for you. I'm curious about it. Like, you know, you had this vision that, okay, I want to be a politician, right? And then somewhere along your journey, you figure out, you know, maybe this is not a good idea, because this image I had about politicians is not the reality of it, right? How was that like for you? Because I'm sure when you are young and when you, like, you know, have certain things that, oh, okay, this is who I want to be, and that's completely different from what you imagine it to be.
So I didn't give you like the whole, like that. I give you the nice clean version of my story, right? So part of my story that I don't tell is that I actually was the executive vice president of, I believe it was the largest political nonprofit in Northeast Ohio at one point. Because I kept my dream going after leaving the court. I kept trying. And I tried a different party, a different branch of like what the potential was. And it just kept, the same lesson kept coming. Like, these people aren't necessarily genuine. The people who believe are genuine, okay? But the people who control things, not so much. And I ran for office. I did do the thing I said I was going to do. I ran for office twice. The first time I had somebody advise me in a very non-explicit way that if I didn't get out of the race, not good things would have happened to me. And so I left that race for my own sake, and I decided to run again. And when I ran again, I got the appropriate promises from everybody I needed to the next time. Stay out of my race, let me run the race. And everything was going really well until they kind of realized that I was doing too well. And then they called in the favors, and I got a call one night saying, "We just received word that we're not allowed to vote for you. And so we're sorry." And like, I had the support of everybody I needed to. And so I sat down and I had to make a decision. Like, is this the path I want to continue walking? Knowing what it is, knowing that there's no real place for an honest person. And I've always considered myself an honest person. Like, my company motto, every single time I've had a company, no matter who I've worked with, is legal, ethical, moral. That's how I do all my business every time. And that's not what I was seeing. That's not the people I was interacting with. That's not what I was getting into. And so I remember, I'll be honest, I broke down completely. I was sobbing, like, just a mess, because like, my path was supposed to be this way, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Who am I? What am I supposed to be? And it was really a tough moment for me in my life when I had to like decide that I wasn't going to do it anymore.
So, you know, when you get that kind of a phone call where you almost get, double quotes, a threat, is it scary? Like, how in a sense, what happens to our brain? I don't know it. Like, how was it for you when you get such a phone call?
So it wasn't actually, he told me in person. The second time there wasn't a threat. I was just told that the race wasn't going to go my way. But it was scary. And I went and I talked to some people who were in positions that they could at least tell me whether or not what was just done to me was true. And I was never given a straight answer. It was, they tap danced, they avoided the question. And so I kind of, I'm willing to accept what's not being said here, and my health, safety, my family is more important to me.
That makes sense. And the other question I had about you actually writing a book.
Yes, I've written several.
No, the one you told me, the elderly law book.
Yes, elder law.
Elder law. Yes. Could you describe what is elder law? Like, I have no clue what it is. Maybe
so. Elder law is the law that surrounds death and dying. So most people understand it as your will, your power of attorneys. So there's the health power of attorney, there's financial power of attorney, there's the living will. So if you if something happens to you, that you're not quite dead yet, but you're not quite alive either. Like, do you want tubes in you or not? Right. But also it's planning for what happens to all of your stuff, really. It's so the court I worked for was the probate court, which is the court that deals with three things, or where I was, with three things: dead people, adoptions, and people who are mentally disabled. And so most of it was dead people. So when I went to the elder law firm, I was dealing with the mostly dead people, I like to say. They weren't quite dead yet. But it's an interesting field of law because not enough people consider their death. Too many people are afraid of even thinking about it. They don't want to think about it. And so I had to have tough conversations with people. Like, you're gonna die. You understand that, right? They worry so much about it. And, you know, I had clients that I knew for 24 hours from the point I met them to the point they died. Because like, they thought about it kind of late, right? Like, thankfully I was able to get in there, get them their documents, run back home or back to the office back then. You know, now it's work from home, but back then it was, I went to the office, typed up their stuff, and then run back out to where they were, usually the hospital, and had them sign it, witness it. And then they were gone within another 20 hours. And then I had to deal with the family. And so that's, you know, so it's wills, trusts, and estates is kind of the overall catchphrase.
Okay. And how is that like? Like, what were you thinking when, you know, you were, I understand the procedural side of things. You make a document, you write things down. But how is it like psychologically for you?
It was strange because, like I said, I was 27 and I had been out of school for a year. Out of school for 1 year, like my entire life up to that point, right? I started school when I was 4 years old. I got out when I was 25. Now I'm 26 when I started that job. And I have to tell people that they're going to die. And I have to tell them that their stuff is going to go to their kids who are probably going to fight over it. And it desensitized me, by and large, to death. I've never been particularly squeamish about it, but the thought of my own death is like, I'm going to die. I could die any second. I could like have a heart attack right here. And other than the act of dying, I'm not concerned about death anymore. But I think it made me kind of a centered person because, you know, the seven habits of highly effective people, you know, one of them is start with the end in mind, right? And I think in his book, he has a picture of a tombstone. So like that's how I approach life now is, you know, when I wake up, like I'm thankful that I'm awake. And when I go to bed, I'm thankful I made it the whole day. And I don't think enough people do that.
26, 27 is really young to think all these things. Don't you think so?
I honestly think we should get younger people more cognizant of it. They should be aware that, you know, the reason we have 18-year-olds join the military is because they think they're immortal and they're never going to die. But if you knew you were going to die, it's going to change your actions. It's going to change your thought process. It's going to change the way you live your life. And I think if we live our life as every moment could be our last, you know, what is going to change in you? How are you going to treat others? Like, what is it that becomes the person that you are with that thought running through your head?
You know, a few of the things I never understood is that, like the, for example, what you are discussing, right? Death is very touchy, not for the person who's going to go through it, but also the family. And you know, there are a lot of people who are already afraid to speak or to confront situations. And I think this is, you are the like the right person to discuss this. Like, how to have those conversations, you know? Because even if you have like a very minor conflict, you want to kind of avoid it. But when it comes to death, right, you simply cannot avoid it. There is no avoiding it. So let's say when you're discussing with the patient or the person or the family, right? Like, what is the approach to talk about these things?
So if I'm talking to the person who's going to die, I mean, we're all going to die, but if I'm talking to the quote client, and I'm not an attorney anymore, so I'm not able to like give legal advice. But if I was talking to the client, my approach was, you can't take it with you, right? Everything that you have is going to become somebody else's. There's no point in concerning yourself anymore, really. And most people, when they get to the point that they see, you're a young guy, like you're probably not there yet. But when you get older, and I'm not there yet either, so I'm not quite capable of doing, but I can understand the process that they're going through because I dealt with it so much. They can see past that invisible line where they're dead. Like they understand that they're going to be there. They don't know where they're going, right? But they understand they're going to get there. And so they understand that when I'm dead, like I'm not taking anything with me. My real trick was trying to get them to understand that their family, assuming they had multiple children, were going to fight horribly. Families do not really stay together after the elders are gone. And it's super rare in my experience to have seen any family, any like brothers and sisters, that level, stick together after the family goes. It's all of the old issues of growing up, all of the pains, all of the pushes, the name calling. It just kind of comes back in full force once they're all gone, once the parents are gone, and they just kind of go their separate ways.
Is it tough for people?
Which people?
the person you're talking to, and you have to kind of tell them that, you know, you might not be there next week. How do they take it? Like, I understand they can imagine it, but do they share, like, how is it for them while they are going to that place?
No. Again, it's an age-based thing, really. The younger you are, the tougher it is, because you think you have more years in you. The older you are, the more you're kind of like, I'm ready to go. Most people, not everybody. It's more so that they're concerned about the people that they're leaving behind. They don't want the division. They don't want the fight. They don't want the anger and the venom that is almost surely to come. It's really rare to see it not. And so that's why when I was an attorney, I helped set up the estate plan and what's going to happen so that your wishes are known. There's no question. There's no need to fight. Everybody gets what you had decided, you know, right now, what you're going to get. And then hopefully they stay friends afterwards.
Yeah. And so, you know, you have seen a lot of these cases, right? Do you see like a pattern where, okay, these are the mistakes everyone is making and these are just very avoidable before you're gone?
Like, stop planning early enough.
What I mean, right? Okay, they don't plan early enough.
It's just not planning early enough, yeah. This is funny. I'm 36 and I don't have a will. With that said, I have one spouse and one daughter. And so, like, when I die in this, where I live, everything goes to my spouse. And I don't have to worry about it going to anybody else, right? But if you have a more complex family situation, if, you know, there was a divorce and someone remarried and you have, you know, stepchildren, and you have to consider it. You have to consider what's going to happen because the knives come out.
I see. Elderly law. So you wrote an entire book on it. So I'm sure this is like one aspect of it. Are there like other aspects which you would like to share about?
Not particularly. It's for me, it was very simple. It's a very simple concept. You know, you die, right? Like, we all die and you have stuff before you die and that stuff needs to go somewhere. And so it's just a matter of deciding where it's going to go. And then you throw in the, well, what if you don't quite die? Okay, well, if you don't quite die and you're not capable of making your own decisions anymore, who do you want to make those decisions for you and how do you want them to make it? And at the end of the day, go hire a good attorney. It's some of the best money you're going to ever spend, because the fights that happen, like I said, I worked at the probate court and I was the bailiff and I saw litigation. I had to stand there the whole time while there was litigation going on and, you know, corral the parties, and they were ready to go to fisticuffs over some of the silliest things. Just because, you know, this was mom's and mom promised it to me. Well, no, mom promised it to me. And they're willing to fight over the smallest things because of that sentimental value. They just, you know, the children, the heirs, they want to hold on to that last gasp of their family, right? And I guess the unspoken aspect of it is the children, the heirs have to come to terms with the death as well. And, you know, I didn't usually have to counsel children. I would if they came in and they brought in their family member. But, you know, what you have to understand that they're going to be gone, and, you know, what it means for you and the fact that you're going to grieve. We would tell everybody that expect at least the very first year after the death of your family member to be really bad, because you're going to have that first, you know, first Christmas without them. And you're like, oh, I remember when, and you're going to have that. And then you're going to have Easter, and then you're going to have, you know, the birthdays. And then after the first year, you know, you've done it without them again. And so it gets easier after that for some people, not everybody.
So you did this and then you went on into international business consulting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did.
Yes. So, you know, how does your day look like now? Like, I'm sure
now,
being an attorney is a completely different, and this is like,
it's not all that much different. So when I was at the law practices, so the elder law firm, I spent most of my day meeting clients. And so now I spend most of my day meeting clients, and it's pretty much the same. When I was doing the law practice with my wife, I spent my time as our research attorney. So there's a difference between a solicitor and a barrister. My wife was the barrister. I was the solicitor, which meant I did all the work, really. And I don't do that so much now. Most of my consulting is consultative. So I speak to people just like this. We'd be on like a Zoom call, and I would be asking you the questions and have you giving me the answers. And it's fascinating, because I think my job is so easy now, because my job is to ask the dumb questions, the questions that you probably ask yourself, but you never actually answer. And so when I ask it, I expect an answer, right? And so you're sitting there, you're like, shoot, like that's exactly what the question I've had. I'm like, okay, we'll go figure it out. I'll talk to you next week.
So when you say business consulting, right, do you work in marketing, operations, or like the legal part of things? Okay, how to raise money, how to put together a contract for the business?
So largely revenue consulting, which touches the marketing consulting as well. I do not do legal consulting. I'm not licensed as an attorney. I don't particularly want anybody to confuse me with that, because, you know, I do go by doctor, and my doctor is from my Juris Doctor, which is my law degree. And anytime anybody finds out that I went to law school, they're like, oh, I can ask you legal questions. I'm like, no. Operations is never something I did particularly, because I've just always been in that consulting position. I never lived in the businesses I was helping. So I'm mostly focused on the revenue, focusing on specifically showing companies that sell products or services, which is hopefully everybody, how to go from being a vendor, someone who just sells the thing, to being a brand. And the brand is the company that's is known, that they're known for being something more than just that product or service.
So, you know, so for example, a vendor comes to you, what are the, you know, lack of information that you see in them, which is kind of, you know, stopping them from going towards being a brand?
It doesn't particularly matter whether they're making $100 a month or they're making like $1 million a month. A vendor is a vendor. And so like you'll see it, you'll find people who like one person shops on Shopify, where they make the thing in their house, and they did really well on Instagram, and they just take pictures of the product and then they sell it, right? But that's it. There's no other business there. There's no other like messaging there. There's nothing there that ties the customer to the company beyond that product. And so it comes, you know, the first thing that you have to have is a mission. You have to have that. What is your purpose? And hopefully it's not just to sell, you know, as an example, you know, pens. Oh, we make the world's best pens. You know how many people say they make the world's best pens? So in law school, like there was a case, the carbolic smoke bomb case. It's a fun one to look up. Maybe it wasn't the carbolic smoke, but I think it was. There is a term called puffery. And puffery is basically legal lying. Okay. And so I can say, this is the world's best pen. And how can I say that it's the world's best pen? Like, what metric am I using? There's no metric. It's my opinion that this is the world's best pen, and therefore I can say it. So if I have the world's tastiest hamburger, who says that? Well, my mom says I have the world's best hamburger, so it's the world's tastiest hamburger, right? Like, not enough people think like that. They don't think that their product can be something great. They just have a product. And so what makes it great? What makes it great? You know, the SaaS product doesn't just help you make more money. It will, you know, make your days easier by doing something, right? Like, it's what is the purpose behind the thing that you're selling, other than just it doing its main function?
And how does that process look like? Like, for example, if you, you know, are building something on your own, you never kind of think about these things when you're doing it. So, you know, when you talk to a client, you know, tell them that, you know, you need to do this as well. Do they take it nicely? Do they have questions? And like, how does that look like?
It's eye opening, and it's the same look on everybody's face every time I consult somebody. It's like, you're so right. Like, I knew I needed to do that. I read somewhere I needed to do that. Someone already told me that I needed to do. Like, they know. Everybody, I think everybody actually does know. I think the real struggle is, I like to use this example. Say Bob makes a really good sandwich, right? And so he's there at home and he makes these great sandwiches and he has barbecues. And when his friends come over, they're like, Bob, you make like the best sandwiches in the world. You should start a business. And so Bob goes, you know what? Yeah, why don't I start a business? So he takes his savings, he goes to get a store and he has to like get insurance and worry about like code violations and all this stuff that he'd never thought he had to worry about. And now he's running the business and he's sitting there wanting to make sandwiches, but like he's got to run the business and there's customers and he goes nuts. The business gets in the way of him realizing that part of it. And I think for most people, that's what it is. They might have that vision when they start of, I'm going to be able to change the world with this thing, but then they get into it. And it's a grind and you have to learn all this stuff that you never thought you would have to do. And maybe you didn't think you were a creative person, but now you're making art because you have to in order to post on social media. And it takes everybody out of their wheelhouse and they lose sight of the vision because they have to look down. I like to say, you know, people have their nose on the grindstone or nose to the grindstone. They never look up at their dreams. You got to take the time to look up again in order to be able to help people the way you always wanted to.
Do you ask them as to, okay, is when you started the company, did you have a vision or a mission? Or is it
that's,
like...
Yes, that's almost always my first step, actually, yeah. So I have a 9-step system that I use. And the very first one is culture. And culture, even if it's a business of one, is the most important thing. What is it you're here for? Why is it you're here? How do you go about doing that? And then, you know, as you bring people on, are they a good fit for your culture? I know too many business owners don't care about that at the start. They just need a warm body. If you could just like do that for me, right? Like I'd be so happy. And what happens? That person almost never works out, right? Like, you have to find someone who's in tune with your business, in tune with the mission of the business before you can really move on. And then after culture, we focus on, you know, what is it you're really selling? How do you package it? Not just in actual packaging, but in the way you frame it for the customer and the journey that they're going to go on from the moment they first hear about your brand to the moment they purchase and beyond.
The word you used, framing, is also the word I was going to say. Like a lot of businesses need like a very intense reframing because the service is great, the product is awesome, but it's like people are not getting it, like why they are for or what they are trying to achieve, you know,
market to message match. Oh yeah, it's that comes down to trying to sell to everybody. You just want to sell your product, right? You want to sell your service. I just need to sell it. I need to make some money, whether it's because I need to pay the bills or because my wife's nagging at me to take another vacation, right? There's some reason you need to sell it and you just want to get more product out there. If you don't know who you're selling to or who you should be selling to and how to speak to that person in the way they want to be spoken to in order to become part of your brand, then you don't have the kind of business that's going to go on and be one of those household names.
Is it like a mental fallacy that people fall into? Because everyone you talk to, right, they are making literally the same mistakes. Doesn't it like sometimes surprise you? Okay, this thing again, you know?
Not particularly. The way you put it, mental fallacy, I think is actually a good way to do it because I'll admit I have done it myself. Like, you know, it's that situation of, you know, physician heal themselves, right? Like you know this. I could tell you exactly how to fix your business. And you're like, well, haha, Brad, I was actually talking about your business. I'm like, ah, like, I know. Yeah, I know. Saying I know is like one of the most dangerous things you can do, by the way. Like, oh, I know. Well, if you know, then you should be doing. And if you're not doing, then you don't really know.
So why I say this, right? Because like businesses have existed in our world since the beginning of, like not exactly in the beginning, but like for thousands of years, right? So shouldn't few things just be just cultural knowledge by now? You know, And they are not.
That depends on the culture, right? You know, you're in a different location than I am right now. And here in the States, as an example, being a salesperson is looked down upon. Like, people don't like salespeople.
Yeah.
In other cultures, salespeople are considered, you know, main drivers of the economy. They look up to them. And so, you know, and even then, you know, the Industrial Revolution, if you really think about it, was only 100, 140 years ago. It wasn't that long ago that we shifted from an agrarian society where there were very few merchants to everybody now having a job and not even considering possibly being on your own. So should it be ingrained in the culture? I mean, I don't particularly think so. I think that's a strain. I think there's a type of personality type, perhaps, of person that just naturally has that ambition and they want something, and they eventually learn through trial and error that the best way to get that ambition fulfilled is by helping others. Right. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, and it's actually a really much longer title. I never remember the full title. The Wealth of Nations talks about the invisible hand, and the people, I think, have the invisible hand confused, because he actually says the people who are focused on their own self-interest, it's as if they're guided by an invisible hand to help other people by seeking their own self-interest.
So, you know, when you say self-interest, right, the question I'm compelled to ask you is, like, before, let's say, you had a daughter, for example. You were a different man altogether. Do you feel after you had a daughter, you changed? And like, if yes, then how so? Like, what all things changed?
Oh man, hopefully my wife can't hear me. So yes, I changed. And I think the change was that I was more tied down. Not everybody feels this way. There are some personality types that don't feel this way, but I felt that I had to go and teach my daughter from even before she was 1 year old, you know, when she was an infant, the ways of the world. And the ways of the world require me to be there with her. Before my daughter, you know, if my wife said she didn't want to go out to a networking event, I'm like, okay, see you later. But if my wife is out and I need to be doing work, like, I have to, like, consider, you know, my daughter's in the other room. If something happens to her, even though if I'm on call, like, I need to go, right? Like, I'm less free in the sense that I have responsibilities. And so I am looking forward to her growing up a little bit more, so I can just let Papa do his thing.
And what do you think about that? Do you think it's great in some ways?
Oh man, wow, that's a tough question. It's not tough. I wish I had more freedom, but I don't regret not having it, because the moments with her are magical. Just not that long ago, just a couple of weeks ago, I was just talking to her and she says, "You know what, Papa, I'm going to help you get more clients." I'm like, okay. And she's 5 years old. Okay. I'm like, okay, how do I do that? She's like, first you need to tell them how you're going to help them. I'm like, okay. And then you need to help them that way. I'm like, that's perfect. That's exactly what you're supposed to do. So I imagine as she grows up, like, she's going to be able to help me more. And the way I've lived my life, I'm not like most Americans. Most Americans, I think it's over 90%, live within 10 miles of where they were born. I've lived in 4 or 5 states at this point. Mm-hmm. Most people on the planet live pretty close to where they were born. So I kind of have a little bit of the immigrant mentality going into every new place I live, right? Because I don't know anybody here. I'm on my own. I have to make it work. And so the way I see it is, she's going to get the immigrant child experience, and she's going to have to work for the family business.
And you know, I've been really reading and trying to understand the culture that is coming in the next, let's say, couple of decades. And I won't say I'm worried about it. All I can say is I'm not sure what we're trying to achieve with the world in general. Like, the media is becoming a bit hazy, I would say. And you are a father of a daughter, right? So you are the right person to discuss this with. Does it, like, how do you think about that? Like, what is happening on the outside?
So, what's that saying? That's the ancient Chinese curse. May you always live in interesting times. I think we are always going to live in an ever-changing world. I mean, imagine what it was like back in that shift from the agrarian society to the industrial society. You had kids and you expected them to work the farm, and now they're going off to the factory and they're gone for 12 plus hours a day, and they come back exhausted, covered in whatever, and oh God, what's going to happen to the children? So, I mean, I think George Carlin put it well, the planet's going to be fine. It's the humans who are in trouble. So when it comes to global warming, you know, the world could end in catastrophe for all we know, or we might find a way to make it work. I do it the same way that I do my business, is I just take it a day at a time. I mean, I can't change tomorrow. No matter how hard I try today, I can't do tomorrow's work tomorrow. I have to do my work today, right? I can't change yesterday either. So the only thing we can focus on is the moment in front of us. So just do the best you can in the way that you can, and, you know, hope that you get good results.
And how do you see raising a daughter? Like, is it a lot of planning the future, or is it?
So the best example I can give you is when she was still really little and we'd have to go anywhere. My wife would get this huge diaper bag and she'd have toys and snacks and changes of clothes and extra rags and you know, bandages and all of the stuff, right? And it would take half an hour to get ready to go. And if I had to go anywhere with her, I would grab the child and maybe a couple diapers just in case, depending on how old she was, right? And then we would go. And so do I plan too much with her? Not particularly. I just know that barring some horrible accident, she's going to be fine. Children are made to get banged up, right? If you ever seen Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, that old claymation thing, stop motion, Bumbles bounce. Well, babies bounce too. So if they fall down, they're made to fall down, they're supposed to get back up. So if they get banged up and bruised, that's just life. And I think a lot of adults forget that. Like, we're supposed to fall down in order to be able to get back up. So no, I don't prepare for my child. I wing it. Which is good. I mean, she's 5 years old. She's doing second grade math already. She's way ahead of her age range.
You know, I've been talking to a lot of recent parents, I would say. So most of their children are only 1, 2, 3 years old. And yeah, we always have like the most interesting conversations, because I really want to understand the thought process of it. Like, how do you decide you want a child right now? Or it just happened? And what are you thinking? What's next? How do you... Like, in my imagination, I don't know how it actually is like. It's like, okay, you had a life, and then this is a new life altogether.
It was morbidly humorous. Before my wife got pregnant, every woman we talked to, every mother and, you know, older woman we talked to, they're like, oh, pregnancy is this wonderful journey. It's so amazing. It's going to be fantastic. And then as soon as we got pregnant, and I'm using the royal we here, right? As soon as my wife got pregnant, we told people, and all those same old ladies were like, oh, honey, it's time to tell you what's really about to happen to you. And the dads were the same with me, like, get ready. So, like, I tell all fathers, and I don't know if every baby is the same, but for me and for every father that I've been able to exchange this with, it's been the same. It's a screaming potato for the first 6 months. That child is not aware of your existence. They just sit there and they scream and they puke and they poop. And it's just this mess. And it's, you don't sleep the entire time. And it's, you're frazzled. But then after 6 months, they kind of have a moment where they just kind of, they wake up and they realize there's stuff around them. And it's absolutely magical to see the difference. I was actually at Disney World when it happened with my daughter. We were sitting there at lunch, and the character Eeyore came up, and she's just a potato, just like staring there. And this character like got in front of her, and she's just like, ah, I just started looking around, like the whole world just opened up for her. And we're like, wow, this is incredible. So it's, as a parent, it's a fun experience. As a business person, it's tough because you have to like account for the fact that you now have this added responsibility that takes a lot of time.
So I want to ask you about like a more general question. You know, I would say there is a lot of discussion right now that the human population is declining, and that's because a lot of people are choosing not to have children at all. And if we continue, like Japan, for example, has more adult diapers now than children diapers. And the same are the discussions about China, that in a couple of years, China, like last year, China's population actually declined a little bit. And, you know, I'm reading all of this and I'm trying to make sense of it. And less people are choosing to have children because there is a choice involved now. Do you see, like, you know, we should be worried about things like this? Or like how, like, you know, for like 30 years ago, we were concerned, okay, we have too many people. And now we are like, okay, we might have too less going forward.
It's cultural. Because there are places in the world where the population is quickly increasing still. You know, speaking of China, they had the one-child policy. You know, it ended a few years back, but the culture was already baked in that you have your one child, and you know, so many people can't afford to have a second. And in Japan, the culture continues to be that work, you know, you have to go to work and you have to really give yourself to the company. And there was no real room for the family. And so, you know, a lot of people who grew up in it saw that and, well, I don't want that, right? And so they just kind of, they're stepping out. You know, Japan specifically, it's, you know, it's so tightly packed that, but I think you're younger than me. So, you know, are you like Gen Z?
Millennial, I think.
Okay. So I'm a millennial as well. And our generation, you know, we can look into the future and see, we can see global warming and the impact it's going to have. And like, do we really want to bring kids into this? I would imagine that should the population start to contract and it actually become an issue, then the populations would increase again. And just because, generally speaking, that's how most animal species work.
And so, you know, it's you mentioned the China's one child policy, and I have been reading a lot of Thomas Sowell over the past, I would say, 1 or 2 years, just trying to understand economics, I would say. So I started with basic economics and applied economics, and then I just, you know, went on and on. And in, I think, one of his books, he mentions that a lot of times when policies are proposed or when policies are made, the decision makers only think about results in the first phase of the policy implementation. So, you know, they'll figure out, okay, this is the problem you're facing right now. And if we, let's say, implement, for example, the one child policy, it will solve the problem in 10 years or 20 years. But what he argues, right, is that a lot of this kind of policies, they also have results after that. And not a lot of people want to think about those results. Like what will happen in 30 years or 40 years or 50 years, right? Like in case of the one child policy, right? When they implement the policy, yes, it solved a problem. But now it is creating more problem than it solved in a way.
Mm-hmm. Unintended consequences.
So, you know, how do you, I don't know, think about that?
So I think about it in terms of having been an elder law attorney, actually. In that I would deal with people who, in some cases, didn't have 6 months left, didn't have 2 years left, and they didn't want to make the decisions that they needed to make because they weren't necessarily concerned about that far into the future. And generally speaking, you know, depends on the political system, politicians don't consider that far into the future. They're concerned about the here and now and making sure things are taken care of right now. Economists think about that far into the future, but you know, no one really listens to them.
Yeah. unintended consequences. Yeah, it was a good read, actually.
Wonderful.
Well, I would say this was fun. I think I learned a lot about... Yeah.
You asked me questions I don't normally get asked on a podcast. This was actually really fun.